Willkommen zum Ox Podcast. Hier ist Ross von Cosmic Psychos. Enjoy vom Crossbeater. Ich liebe dich. How you going, yeah? How you going, yeah? How you going, yeah? G'day, Ross from the Cosmic Psychos. Welcome to the first episode of How You Going, the show where I sit down for a drink and catch up with one of my mates. You'll know the bloke in this episode is the front man for UMI, and recently the Hard-Ons. He's also got a cracking solo career going and seems to be playing music all over the place, as well as popping up in Hollywood movies and on the telly. He's an ARIA winner both as a solo artist, shitloads with UMI, an absolute North Melbourne Football Club tragic, and he's even written a book about his life. Whew. He's ditched city life for the bush over the last few years, and he doesn't live too far from me now. Welcome to the bush, Tim. It was a sunny day late February when Tim came out to the farm for a visit, showed him around all the nooks and crannies, and we sat down in the shed for a bloody good yarn. And before we settle in, I want to let you know that all this podcast hoo-ha has been made possible by our sponsors in Liquid Gold, thanks to Bodriggy Brewing and Heaps Normal for helping keep the party going no matter what the party looks like. And of course, the Cosmic Psychos have a new album coming out November the 7th, that's 2025 by the way, and it's called I Really Like Beer. We'll be taking on the road across 40-odd dates through Australia and we'll be hitting Europe and the States next year. I'm told you should hit the website if you want to get violent with it onto tickets or make sure we're coming your way. CosmicPsychos.com.au. All right then. So, Tim Rogers, how you going?
Real good, Roscoe.
Welcome to the farm.
It's great to be here. It's, I've visualised it many times. Not in a creepy way, of course, but no, just knowing that we're neighbourly.
Yeah. Yeah, so what is it? How, why, and why Tarradale?
My missus grew up in Bendigo, and then when she joined the Australian Ballet as a dancer, was really homesick for Bendigo, and so she commuted from the Go to the Ballet Centre in town, and she used to go through Tarra on the train. I knew I needed to get out of St Kilda. I just couldn't walk out the door and someone would go, come on, let's get on it.
Yeah.
So we're looking for somewhere to live out near folks in Bendigo, and a lady friend of ours took us to Tarra and said there's a half-built house there that was affordable. Because when we were looking for a loan, and I thought that Alice's position as a world-renowned ballet choreographer and me as a D-list celebrity, that getting a loan would be okay, but we got laughed out of the building and it was all virus-associated, and because they said, you know, can we see your statements from last year? And it's like, you know, there's a bloody pandemic going on. Made nothing. And so we've got this half-built house and just been building and finishing it since.
Unreal.
Best decision I've ever made.
Yeah, it's hard. I've gone for loans over my years, especially when I had a breakup with the boy's mother years ago. And if I'd been the bloke that I paid, he could have got a loan. But because I don't have a wage slip, don't have anything like that, it's sort of like, and my supplementary money was for music, which is, as you know, is not very consistent and not a lot of, but it was bloody hard.
The inconsistency of it really bites you on the bum, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because you have those periods where you think, oh, I'm set for a while, and then come tax time or, you know, paying all the bills, and then it just goes and think, oh, shit. So getting other jobs has been really good. I think actually the last time that we saw each other, I was working at the ESPY, which I'm really glad I got that job because it was good having cash in hand. Just apart from landscaping and lawn mowing, hadn't had a day job for ages because of the inconsistency of what we do. Again, now, a little bit of bar work, bit of lawn mowing. Anyway, you know.
Yeah, and it's, well, I'm sort of got the, well, I got the bulldozers to always to fall back on.
Yeah.
So the bloke that works for me, he's buggered. He did his knee, so.
Oh, do you own the dozers?
Yeah. That truck up there. I've got a couple of dozers, but I sort of semi-retired from it a couple of years ago, and just I've got one bloke that's been working for me for 30 years.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to stop, so I said, "All right, I'll keep everything until you want to stop, because I can't just pull the rug out from underneath. You know, sort of wouldn't be fair." But he went and did his knee, the bastard. And I'm back on the tools, I'm back on the machine. 4:30 every morning, mate. I'm used to going to bed at 4:30, not getting up at 4:30.
It's the cruel vicissitudes of being a we're not aging because we're in our autumnal years. I like to look at it. So do you hire them out? Or
no,
you
I just drive them. Yeah, we just go and dig dams. So if you rang me up and go, hey, mate, can you dig me a dam or dig me a house site or something like that, I'll go and do that.
I'm actually looking to some folks moved out from near us and they had a shipping container on the land. And so now they've moved the shipping container. It's a perfect length and width of cricket nets.
Ah.
Oh, it's always been a dream since I was about two to have cricket nets. I think I read that Rod Stewart had a soccer pitch in
his
house.
That's right, he did too, yeah.
So I think one day I'll never have a cricket oval or a footy oval, but nets.
And just by, say, one of the bowling machines, it'd be unreal.
Yeah, having a bowling machine, but just the thought of actually that they make bowling machines as a kid.
Yeah.
Because as soon as I'm at cricket nets or practice or on the field, I'm straight back to when I was 13.
Yeah.
Chunderingly nervous before getting to the ground.
What's your routine? Do you have a special? Oh, when I played cricket down at Mai for like 35 years. I was the worst wicketkeeper in the world.
Oh, no, you're not now because I know the worst wicketkeeper.
Oh, really? How many – in my first game with the gloves, because they had wicketkeeper left, I was in form two. So what's that, 14?
Yeah.
And I go, who's keeping wickets?
Because
I was going all right with the bat as a junior. And, yeah, obviously not quite playing for Australia. And they go, yeah, you are. And I go, great. So that innings – I let through 37 byes, so I've never done it before.
I shouldn't laugh, but I am.
But I made up for it because I made 40-odd for the game. So I
even the ledger.
Three games in credit. But
it's flipping hard. I mean, I got asked last week, we were playing Harcourt, and Gumpy, our keeper, it was one of those really hot days, and call came up, and my intuition is to go, yep. And I thought, oh, shit, I've never wicket kept before, and I'm sure it's a harder art than I presumed. You know, it's not just standing there, and it's easy because you got the big bloody gloves on. But the ritual is feel like you're going to spew, even if it's playing, you know, C grade. Mm. And it's not that I take it particularly seriously, but just can't stop the nerves. And like those Community Cup games we played, we've both played in front of thousands and thousands of people. I've never been so fucking nervous as playing those games.
Mm.
But then I try and remember the old Keith Miller quote when asked, what's it like facing the West Indies, Wes Hall and all those fast bowlers? And he said, because he was a fighter pilot, and he said, it's not like you got a Messerschmitt up your ass.
Yeah. We had some good hit-outs over the years. Yeah. Some of those games were quite good. I remember when I could still actually play and run. They were quite spirited. They were very good games.
And a little bit of niggle there. Yeah. There was one game, I kicked 3-4 and got concussed by Tommy Elliott, who was playing for Megahertz, because he hit me from behind, and I deserved it. Oh, no, it wasn't him. It was some Ant B squared, that's right. But I was mouthing off to Tommy and probably did something stupid. So he had every right to bash me in the back of that. But I got concussed. And that night I was a single man and spent the night with a lovely lady. So the next morning I had to go and get a brain scan. So I walked into the Alfred, I walked out of the Alfred, knowing I'd had a wonderful evening, kicked 3-4, dogs won by a point, and I was looking around for the Channel 7 cameras. I thought, if this is what being a footballer is, it's fucking better than being in a rock band. You know?
Fuck yeah, I played in – I made a comeback at the age of 35 in at Kyneton, and that was in the – when they won two or three flags in there. But I was only – I was in the Magoos, but I was only a bus crash away from a game in the seniors. I always used to say that.
Oh, that's grim, man.
Well, that's about how far away I was for a game of the seniors. We needed 25 to die, and I would have been probably on the bench for the seniors, I reckon.
Fuck, that's a brilliant line.
I actually want to know how's it going with the Hard-Ons? Because one of my favourite all-time bands, and a band that we played with so much in the 80s, and I think we played with them on their first. Pretty sure it was their first or second trip down. They would have played the free night at the Prince of Wales on the Thursday night, the Thursday night crawl night.
Yep.
And they came down and a girl in the sweater had come out and I loved it. And it was that, you know, because, you know, you get no contact again until they walked in the door.
Yeah.
And got on with them like a house on fire. They were great blokes, but just loved them. And we played so many shows with them. Did they approach you or you?
I definitely didn't put my hand up because I was the guy, 16, 17. They were the first band I travelled around to see, and the Hellmen and Mass Appeal. That was the holy triumvirate for my brother and my best mate Nick and I. And I'd catch a train from Parramatta into town to Sydney Cove or never saw him at the trade. But I was the one up front mouthing lyrics, trying to catch Blackie or Ray's eyes, like, oh, I'm the kid. And then we were sort of acquaintances and friends. And then I wrote Ray a couple of fan letters years and years later when they put out a couple of singles, Darth Vader Pretends, which was part of Unbelievably Bad magazine, Peel Me Like an Egg, that record. So I'd just write to Ray and say, fuck, you're better than ever. And then virus was going on. I was on a pub crawl with my best mate Mick Sayers, walking through St Kilda. We were about a day and a half into a good session. And I got this call, Ray Arn, and picked it up. And he went, Tim, how you going? And I said, yeah, Ray, I'm really good. Is this happening? And he said, look, we want to ask you to sing for the band. And I said, sure, I'll give it a try. Who else are you thinking? And he said, well, we want to give different singers a go. This thing's happened with Kesh. And Blackie doesn't want to sing anymore. And I said, well, yeah, I'll drive up and give it a go, thinking that there'd be a line of 40 people. And he said, no, I think you're the right guy. And he said, we'll do a record and maybe a tour and see how it works. And then 5 years later and four records later. But for them to ask me, I was ready for it, that I was going to cop it from people who really love different versions of the band, and I'd cop it every night. There's, you know, three death threats and a couple of people bow me up and want to smash my head in and get lots of messages, you know, you suck. But they're back to a three-piece at the moment because they're setting up to do a US tour with Jerry A from Poison Idea singing, which unfortunately I found out through social media. And we had a gig that night with the Hoodoo Gurus and Ray was distraught and Blackie came and said, oh, I was so sorry. But I said, that's the way it was only supposed to be one record.
Yeah.
And if they got the opportunity to play with Jerry, you fucking take it. I mean, he's an operatically good singer, rock and roll singer, punk singer.
Good bloke.
And he's a ripper fella.
Yeah, he's a lovely fella.
So they'll do stuff and then if they feel like calling me back whenever, and if they don't, I've just had the best couple of years with them, you know. And I get asked a bit, how do they feel about you getting on the piss and, you know, dressing like a lark and all that. If I missed a show, that'd be a problem.
Yeah.
And they'd rake me over the coals. But I haven't missed a show yet. I've done some bad ones, but most of them have been really good. And I love the way Blackie writes. He just writes riffs and riffs and songs and sends them to me and asks me to collaborate with him on it.
Unreal.
They're the best.
But they're a great bunch to hang out with. As I said, that's some good times. Only time Ray ever got upset with me, I blew his galley and Kruger up in Sydney on New Year's Eve. It was God, Psychos and the Hard-Ons on the floor at the lounge down.
On the floor?
On the floor. So it was sort of, there was just this lounge. It was just the actual lounge. There was no venue in the lounge down then. It was just sort of, they took all the tables out. It was a little room and it was stinking hot. And I said to Ray, can I borrow your amp? He goes, yeah, all right. Anyway, it just had a meltdown because God had used it as well.
Right.
Like Tim.
Hemo wouldn't mind cranking it.
Hemo had cranked it up to 500 as well. So it had a meltdown. So he was a bit pissed off with me that night. Did you know that I really like beer? Well, I'm here to tell you about a bloody ripper of a Victorian beer called Bodriggy Brewing. And I bloody love them because they brew beers that taste like beer. It's beer so good, we're making a Cosmic Psychos draft with them. Available on tap at all good pubs. If your local doesn't have it, ask them why. Good on you, Bodriggy. How'd you go with Michael Fewings? Did Pop Fewings did? Because
I forgot about you and Pop. You gave him the name Pop, didn't you?
Yeah, we called him Pop because he used to pop off all the time. But he was our sound guy for years and years and years. And, oh, fuck, we had some funny time. Yeah, Pop and I, we go back a long way.
Well, he comes to Europe with us.
Yeah.
And I just love him. What was the big eye-opener for me, because I didn't know Michael at all, but he said, oh, I used to mix you a couple of times. And he gave me that look like you were a bit of a cunt.
Yeah.
But when my daughter came, she lives in New York, and she came to Europe with us to sell merch, and she just clung to Pop.
Yeah.
They were drinking buddies, and if Ruby loves something, I just might, you know, go, it must be the best thing ever. And so I just saw him in a new light.
Yeah.
And then when he just comes up with these, you know, oh, Timmy, did I tell you about the Urge Overkill tour? Yeah. His stories are just the best.
And he's funny. And he did tell you when he pissed in my suitcase. I never took a suitcase on tour again after this, mind you. It's my first tour of Europe. So I was sharing a room with him in Sweden, bloody walk-in robe, and I go, oh, I'll put my suitcase in there. So Pop and I went and got on the Terps.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's got up during the night and opened the door and thought it was a dunny. Because I got up in the morning, my T-shirt's wet. And I go, what the fuck? And I'm looking for wet pipes and everything like that. No, it's Pop.
Who spilt the chicken soup?
Yeah. Well, I just said, let's close it. We'll put it in the back of the van. We'll see how it goes in the sun after a few hours. But to his credit, Pop said, yeah, I must have done it. Give us your suitcase. I'm off to the laundromat. So he's a good man, Pop.
He's great ethically completely sound.
Oh, yeah.
Those European tours are pretty discombobulating, as brilliant as, you know, my God, you're in Germany one day, France the next. You can catch yourself going, I don't actually know where I, you know, what country I'm in. And I always try and affect a little bit of an accent, if not get the language, which I think drives the hard on guy's nuts, because like the pretentious wanker. And, well, look at me. I'm in gold pants. Of course I'm a pretentious wanker, but I think it'll get us served quicker.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, because Ray will go, oh, can I grab a schnitzel? And the lady go, oh, yes, handsome Australian-Korean bass player for the hard-ons. Yes.
Perfect. Now, in Germany, Fünfgross beer bitter. That's all I learned. That's all you need.
All you need. Well, it's definitely going to make your day easier.
Yeah. We try not to have a night off.
Yep.
Because we get, I don't know where you go, but our nights off, I end up fucking hammered.
Oh, yeah, of course. And, you know, and the band and the conversation, well, maybe we should go out for dinner.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll say, well, there's a theatre show in, down in Dusseldorf. And no fucking way. You get there, it's on.
Yeah.
Rat us. And you haven't got the gig to sweat it out.
No. Yeah, you've got, yeah, and you're paying for everything. No, and you end up yelling and screaming all night because you've got fucking 14 bottles of schnapps or something, and then your voice is in worse condition than
if you did
day.
A couple of shows. Yeah.
So we just like to play every night.
Yeah.
Because it's just easier.
Yeah.
It's hard to say that, but because it's something I never got when I was young.
No.
I'd be in Europe on those ridiculous 50, 60 date tours going, oh, it's fucking Wednesday. I just want to be home.
Yep.
I want to be in my shed. I just want to be on the couch. I don't give a fuck. I miss footy. I just want to be home. It took a while, but when you realise that every time as you get there, it doesn't matter how you feel, it doesn't matter if there's 10 people there, 100 people or 500 or one, they've paid dollars to get in and you've got to give them something.
Yeah.
Or crack the shitties and walk off. It's sort of like, no, you got to give it to them. You got to give them something.
I had a guy write to me, again, it was social media, and found a way of getting to me, and he wrote and said, you fuckwit, I saw you play in Philadelphia 15 years ago and you didn't give a shit. And you had a bag of blow in your pocket and, you know, you were just disgraceful. Pavement played the next week and they were brilliant and fuck you, rot in hell. And I thought, well, this is kind of quite direct. And I remember the show, oddly, because I actually wasn't that trolleyed, but he's possibly right. And I didn't give it my all and I should apologise, but the rotten hell, I thought, well, fuck you, I'm not going to write back to you.
Jeez, he's held that on for a long time.
Yeah, it was an odd one. And but I got alerted to it because a friend of mine said, oh, Tim, my God, you cop that all the time. I said, yeah, people just feel absolutely at liberty to write. But then I thought, well, I can't write back and go, well, bugger you, you don't understand how he is, because who knows what he was going through. And,
and
the perception is that it's just all easy and fun, and but you should, I think, perpetuate that perception, because it's rock and roll music. It should be fun. And if you have to really lift yourself up to do it, it's not like you've got a Messerschmitt up your ass. No, although there was a night in Dusseldorf when someone tried.
Oh, bloody hell.
I heard this great story from Marie Robertson, who wrote that great book on Geelong and Barwon. But she said she loved the Hard-Ons because they'd turn up with their sleeping bags. But Blackie's thing, because he's so fit, it's finding a gym in the morning. And I used to really love not helping, because he's all over it, but I'd always promise, yeah, Blackie, I'll be with you and we'll go and do a workout in the morning. And, of course, you know, get on it and miss the session. But that's his way of the day, you know. And I love that. And those three guys are so different. Then we'd meet up before a show and everyone would have their stories about, oh, I just went walking through East Berlin today, or the bloody Stuttgart. And so you're not together all the time. And hunting in a pack, you know. Yeah. I think on touring it's pretty good to be able to wander off by yourself a bit. Do you do that?
Yeah, we do now. Like, it's just we keep talking about how we're not getting old, we're just getting in autumnal. But I've found it a bit different. I tend to go off and do my own stuff now. Mm. Yeah, you don't have to feel like you have to be in each other's pockets. And
I think it's important.
Yeah, at that time.
On tour, you know, when you take friends on tour or partners, 3 days and they lose it.
Yeah.
The 3-day rule. Because you have to explain to people, look, everyone's just looking for a clean part of the floor or a bit of tucker or whatever they need to get through the day. And it gets perceived as being selfish if you just go quiet or go off by yourself. But you have to.
Yeah, you got to. Like, Macca will go for his walk. He goes for a wander. But I like me little. I like to have a little grandpa nap.
Oh,
I have. I get up first Fuck thing. Yeah. I want to do in the morning is have a look in the van, get that cold beer, especially in Europe.
Yep.
There's nothing wrong with that. Or stop at the servos, and where you just want to buy the one or two.
Yep.
Because you don't want to
keep yourself nice.
Yeah. Yep. And just have a safety piss, and then have a little nap.
Yep.
So I don't do sound checks at all. Always thought they're a waste of time. So I just go to the hotel, have a couple of brewskis, and go to sleep.
Yeah.
And if we're on at 9 or 9:30, I'll get there at about 8:45, and just wander in and crack a beer and go, hey, how's everyone going? When Dean was, Dean's just left the band.
Oh, he has left.
Yeah. He said he doesn't want to do it anymore. So he's having a
just. Touring?
No, the offer was out there. I said, do you want to still play or record? And he said, no, I want a complete break. So he's it came out as a bit of a shock. We're still trying to get over it a bit, really. So
just a mixture of things. It wasn't.
His mum's crook. And I think just he's very, very busy. And I think he felt he wanted to keep an eye on the business and stuff and help. Right. He felt a bit bad about leaving, jumping ship. Because we're sort of playing a lot more now than what we have done for a while.
Yep.
Yeah, and he just, after 20 years, he's gone on a, indefinite hiatus or whatever.
The jumping off, I think it was 2019, just before the latest pandemic, I was ready to jump off. And that's why I got the job at the ESPY. But I couldn't tell the UMI guys it's over.
Hmm.
Well, we tried to ask other singers to come in. Sarah McLeod from the Supergizzers was our first choice because we all really love her and she's got the strong voice. And anyway, it didn't work out. Then we had to stop playing for a while and I couldn't wait to get back on stage. And I guess we're just in it for life, really. And
so how many years now? I was trying to think about how long.
I started touring when I was 19. I was playing a couple of bands at uni and high school. But touring from 19, I first toured with Boxer Jesuit in maybe 87, I think, 88, 89, which was a good introduction because they were a bit older. And through them I met people like John Murphy and Michael Sheridan and it was just through touring with them.
Yeah.
And so by the time you and I were touring, I thought, I can do this, you know.
That's pretty good because it's basically the same. Just David came on board, 15 years ago? 20?
Oh, it's longer than that. And, he came on in 98, 99.
Yeah. So it's been the same.
Yeah.
All the way.
Yeah, Russ a couple of years ago said he's had enough. He said it was physical.
Right.
And he's only he just turned 60 the other week. But he'll outlive us all.
Yeah.
Because he's just really good at it. But I think it's because he's interested in everything. And so his interest and his intrepidness, loves touring, loves writing, photographing, you know, smoking everything from every plant on the man. And I think that it was irresistible. He thought, well, if I don't tour, that this part of my life will be, I won't have that anymore. So we're kind of re-energised at the moment. Yeah. We'll see how it goes.
I mean, you're only as old as how you think.
Yeah, I'm 55 and I do think back to my dear darling dead dad about how I perceived him when he was 55 and his mates, and I could feel him kind of not shut down but closed down, and I think it was physical ill health. He was really sick for decades and this very smart, lovely, lovely man got a bit flinty and a bit hard-edged, and part of the keeping physically upright is about not letting that bitterness and anger get hold of me. And I've noticed that I've got real potential to get that way. A couple of times when I've found dragging my heels and I get a bit narky about mates who are doing well and envious. And I felt that if I'd kept physically all right, that all just goes away and I just don't get jealous of anything or envious of anything or bitter about anything?
The weight, I'd be buggered without the weights. It's the only thing that's kept me alive, really.
Do you try and do stuff on tour, health-wise, or...?
Try to. I have a grand plan at the start of every tour like we do. And I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And it'll go down. I'll say to Macca, right, it's 100 push-ups and 100 air squats every day.
Yep.
We'll just do them. And we're going to walk 10K.
Yep.
That's usually at the airport halfway to Europe.
Yep.
We decide on that. But I had to, if I find myself going into a hole, I'll find a gym.
Yep.
And I'll just go and squat, deadlift, bench. That's all I'll do. Or just chuck something above my head or something. But I know if I feel a hole coming, I don't have, like the last time I went to Europe, I didn't go to a gym once, but I was in a real good state.
Yep.
But yeah, I run straight to the weights. I can feel it coming in.
Yep.
So yeah, if I feel like I am getting angry or just the dark clouds are coming, I'll go, I'm going to go and squat. And I don't care if it's 7 o'clock in the morning or 10 o'clock at night. So I'll come up here and just lift as much weight as I possibly can, and that sort of And then I come good.
It makes you feel as if you're capable to jump over anything. Being able to feel that it's coming, you know, that's a big one because I've got friends with worse conditions than mine, and it comes out of nowhere, and they're incapacitated and. It just sort of rules their life, and I'm lucky that I can feel it coming. And when I've painted myself into a corner, then get on my hoof and go walking.
Yeah.
So in my suitcase to start for this UMI tour, which starts I think next week, I've got an all-weather cover, you know, and because it scrunches up into nothing.
Yeah.
But that's the first thing. It's not the purple boots or the bloody gold lame flares this time. It's an all-weather hooded jacket that I can wear because I'm often going dark. I'm just going to go walk for 20Ks or 10Ks or whatever. Wherever it is, and I'll be a good bandmate again.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I got a few people look out for me too. They know when if I can't see it, they'll go, Karen will say, how long since you've trained? I think you better pop up the gym.
Right.
And I'll be thinking I'm fine, but apparently I'm not.
Yeah.
So, but usually I can see it coming, but I'm pretty lucky to be able to get out of it.
Because
I only drink to be happy. I never drink to be sad.
Yep.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Having a beer in my hand is life's greatest personal pleasure for me. Just I can do it myself. I can do it on my own, and I'll be as happy as a pig in shit.
Yeah.
Because if I drank to be sad, I wouldn't drink.
Well, it got brought up by a former partner of mine, and that's what we used to do, is to drink together and love each other. And like she said, you really drink yourself sad. That's stuck with me, and I've noticed that because I've never drank to be social. If I can drink at home, I'd rather do that.
Mm.
Whack on records or what? Watch a movie or watch a footy game or just sit out looking at the mountains, you know, whatever. But that, drinking yourself sad thing is something that I do, and so I'm having to reassess everything at the moment.
Yeah, if someone else told me that, I think I'd have to do something about it. But our European tours now, they're all about the lunch. So we get up and have a couple of beers and we go, right, we've got an autobahn from A to B, but there's a castle. And it's 20 minutes off the autobahn there, and it's open. They do schnitzels. So we'll go there. So it's not about the gig. I mean, it is about the gig, but it's not about the gig. It's about the lunch.
Need to concentrate on something else other than the show, just to keep your wits about you. The what's the hour count that you can eat before a show?
Oh, lunch.
That's it.
That's it. I cannot eat a thing.
No.
I'll just stop dead. I'll be like a statue. I'll want to fall asleep.
Yep.
I'm fucking hopeless.
Yep.
Like I might, if there's a little platter there, I might just grab a dry bicky or a seaweed cracker, something real light. But no, I can't. I just can't.
Nah.
It's impossible.
Ray and Bucky have dinners before.
I couldn't do it.
I'm in total admiration. I'd love to be able to do it, but no fucking way. And so in Europe recently, because you get those hotel brekkies and can chuck a couple of eggs down, and so it'd be brekkie and then, you know, a bunch of beers away from everybody and then that was it. And then about 3 weeks later and you wonder why you're turning green and vomiting up blood. And so, right, okay. Yeah, lunch.
Yeah, lunch. The chats, they somehow can eat before a show. Like, I'll eat a full steak and get out there and just go flat chat for 40 minutes. I don't know how they can do it. Macca does. Macca's good. He can eat whatever he can beforehand, but he usually falls asleep halfway through the set. I've looked over there sometimes. His eyes are closed, but he's still strumming. He's actually nodded off.
If you're a bit like me and you want to say no to water, then be like me and always keep a slab of Heaps Normal in the fridge. It'll get you through those good times that are too good to be wasted. And when I'm on the dozer, Heaps Normal non-alcoholic beers give me the same heavenly taste of beer when I just can't afford the hassle. I call them stunt beers because you get all the action without anyone doing a mischief to themselves. Heaps normal, too good to be wasted.
A lot of people getting sick.
Yes.
A lot of people getting sick. And it's kind of like you know, and just people die. Just people die. But it's dealing with that. Like, I'm sort of grieving Dean leaving the band a little bit, but he's still alive. I don't know why I'm so upset about it. But if someone actually just can't, like when Rocket died, yeah. Robbie Rocket died, it's yeah. sort of, I don't think you ever get over that kind of shit, really.
No. Had to think about the other day and thought I'm not actually ready for someone that close to die again. You know, you kind of don't ever get over grieving, as you know very well. But the you think, okay, I can sit with it now and go for a wander and talk with someone if up in the clouds if I want to. But I thought I'm not prepared for this. And I guess the way that we can pay tribute to folks is to, you know, live a best life and keep them in our hearts and thoughts. And when Goose the Box Jesuit singer, and who was my hero, and he died so young, he was in his early 30s. And
yeah, I remember that.
He was the smartest guy I knew and the funniest. And we were making our first album in Minneapolis at the time, and just devastated me. I just thought, I'm going to go home and he's not going to be there, you know?
Mm.
When you mentioned Rocket before, because the first time we really met was in West Hollywood, and it was the night after you'd had a big win in Las Vegas.
That's right.
I mean, it was a great psycho show, but you... The three of you were just on this kind of post-Vegas yeah. thing, which you've got to go gangbusters yeah. in Vegas.
And absolutely.
It was just the most incongruous meeting, yeah. you know, these four Australians talking about the footy season in West Hollywood, and you just had a big win in Vegas. And it was just, oh, I thought, it doesn't get better than this.
Funny place to meet. And you were saying that your daughter came over and did merch?
Yeah.
Unreal. Because I've been a rock and roll dad for, you know, for best part of 30 years. So how did you go? I found it... I used to take the boys on tour with me,
yeah.
which was quite difficult sometimes, but not overseas, of course. But the long stages away, I mean, that was probably, for me, just personally, that was the hardest bit for me, was leaving the kids.
Yeah.
And you know, dumping everything on to the kids' mother at that stage. I felt like I was deserting the ship a bit.
Yeah.
But I was actually over there trying to make some dough.
Some dough.
Yeah. yeah. And hard to say to people, no, I'm actually working. I'm playing every night for 40 nights.
It's a little difficult to explain because it looks like fun the whole time when, as we know, it's not all the time. When Ruby was born, her mum and I had such a difficult relationship. Just weren't suited. We were very much in love and in lust. And I had a really difficult time with it being away from Ruby, and then when her mum and I split up was when Ruby was very young, and kind of went into free fall, was really despairing, trying to be a good dad and yet just medicating, for lack of a better term. And now when she's a young woman, I try and explain some decisions that we made early on, and she'll just kind of touch me on the hand and go, Dad, I know who you are, you know, for better or worse. But she's now making records herself. Her record will be out in a couple of months. It's fucking unreal. It's just this power pop masterpiece. And her mates in New York are these really savvy, smart New York kids who are actually really good fun to hang out with. So I'll go over and hang out with her, and I can tell her stories now, and her friends will go, "Oh, all right." So she'll ask me and say, "Dad, did Julian from The Strokes really babysit me?" And I said, "Yeah, that happened." And, you know, one of the first gigs was side of stage for the Stones, all these kind of stories. Yeah. And you know, it's, you learn so much from your kids. And I'm learning from her every day. You know, she's a very measured kid. And I don't know what it's like with a young man and boys, but with Rubles when she was, you know, a teenager in New York, and I was just this ball of worry, you know.
Yeah.
She had a couple of friends pass away to sort of drug misadventures, and just worry.
Yeah. Yeah, my young bloke heads off to the army on Tuesday.
No shit.
Yeah, 18. It's unreal.
Could you see his decision heading that way? Or
3 years ago, mate, when he was 25 kilo overweight, vaping and eating shit. No.
Yep.
And trying to drag him out of bed to go to school every morning. I'm like, I had to allow 2 hours just to get him out of bed. But yeah, he joined the Army Cadets, just transformed his whole life.
And that was his own decision?
Yep, just... Yeah. Because I'm not a pushy dad. I'd sort of come and do some weights with dad and do you want to play footy? When he was little, I took him swimming, little athletics and all that kind of stuff just to get him interested in and hopefully team sports just to learn how to work with people instead of individual sports. But no, I wasn't interested. Now he's the ultimate team man now. So he's off.
And he's happy, right?
Oh, shit, yeah. 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 I mean, it's pretty quiet around the world now. What could possibly go wrong?
Yes, the boat's off Chinese boat's off the Tasman. Flight's being diverted.
That's all good. But he said, "Oh, what do you think, Dad?" He goes, "Are you up? Are you worried?" You know, when he made the decision a year ago to go in, I said, "Well, two choices in life, mate." I said, "You can be shot at, or you can be paid to be shot at." So you've done well. So that's all, the only advice I could give him. So
fucking good on him. Yeah. You know, just when you look at your kids and go, "Well, I could say something," but they're smart. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he's a fit Phil, 6'1", ball of muscle now, running and fit and full of beans. It's pretty good. But geez, I took him over to Seymour to get his licence like 2 days after he turned 18. And this is how quickly it changed. So he gets his licence. I just went and sat and got a coffee, come back, and he goes, "I'll drive home, Dad, got me licence." I go, "Good on you, mate." And we get to the first intersection. I go, "Yeah, I think someone's coming." And he goes, "Do you want to get in the back?" Straight up. So that was it. I knew then my authority was gone.
Yeah, yeah.
Just shut the fuck up. I
couldn't. Pops, come on.
That's it. I'm done. Yeah, yeah. Get off me, Grandpa. Bloody hell. So, Tim, they say you should never meet your idols, but have you met your idols?
The only folks I've met who have been horrible have been folks who are playing at the same level. Tends to be, no, not necessarily just overseas acts, American acts that we'd be touring with, and they'd just be so snooty and look down their noses at us. But there's no heroes of mine that I've met who have been fucked. Oh, Patti Smith was a little difficult, but she was tired and she didn't want to be having dinner with a 26-year-old Australian. The guitarist in the band, Lenny Kaye, is a real big hero of mine, and so I just let Patti push around her sushi and chat to Lenny Kaye about Nuggets Records and some other things he's done. But yeah, the big ones, you know, the Pete Townsends and Keith and Westberg were all brilliant.
Unreal.
Have you had a bad experience with anyone?
No, I'm a bit too shy. I mean, I can't. Yeah, I only had one bad experience. That was with Roland Howard, because I was pretty young and he was young, like probably about the same age. And I was going, Elvis Costello, when he came out first, and he was out there trying to scab tickets, and he comes up to me and he starts poking me in the chest and going, he was hanging out with a heap of older blokes, I don't know who they were, but he's going, got a ticket, like really fought, like I'm just a school kid.
Yeah.
You know, I drank half a bottle of Star wine, I was pissed. And then I went to see him, the birthday party play at the ballroom, and I was ringing a cab to go back, I was living in Footscray at the time, I'm bringing a cab, and then Roland Howard walks up and I go, "Oh, g'day, mate." I said, "Look, I've just seen, thanks, that was a great gig. I used to go and see him a lot."
Yeah.
"I really enjoyed it." He goes, "Get out of the fucking phone box. I want to use the phone." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, fair enough." Mm. So it was a bit like that. I was a bit disheartened by that. When he did that to me, I thought, I don't give a fuck how annoying anyone is. I'll always say hello.
Yep.
I'll always have a little bit of time to go, "Yeah, g'day," or whatever. But I'm on a very small level, so it doesn't happen very often.
But I had this one with Ian Ryland where read an interview and he rubbished me, just saying I was a bit beige. And I thought, oh, that hurts a bit because I love Ian. Then he was on a plane I was on and he asked the person next to me to move, and Ian came and sat down, and he was pretty crook by that time, but he was just up for the chat. And I thought, I'm not even going to bring up that he kind of broke my little heart, because it was great just having a yarn to him.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of the first couple of times meeting Perkins and touring with the Beasts, and I just idolised, and to a large extent still do, Tex. And he was so sweet to me, and it just caught me off guard, because I think I went in, "Oh, hi."
Yeah.
And he was like, "G'day, come and sit down. Do you want a singer?" It happens with footballers and cricketers more, that they'll be a bit dismissive, like, remember meeting Dennis Pagan, coach of the century, and Peter Bell, who was playing with us at that time, introduced me to Dennis, and Dennis went, "G'day, young fella, how you going?" Shook my hand, and he turned to Peter and went, "Right, who's he?"
Right.
So little situations like that where you're just a fish out of water, or Met Malcolm Blight, and I just thought he was the most stoned person I've ever met. But he was quite, you know, what are you doing here? So he wasn't rude at all. Yeah. It was just it didn't quite fit.
Yeah.
I just know because of the way I look, or, you know, a little bit silly looking, and that sort of expect people to be a bit, yeah, where do you fit in this picture? And,
yeah.
But to remember that it takes so little to make people feel comfortable, and you never know what's going on in someone's day. So if someone introduces themselves to you awkwardly, sit down, I'll buy you beer, you know, whatever. Maybe they needed it that day, you know.
I accidentally bumped into Pete Wells. I always liked Pete Wells.
Great fun.
I went down and watched him play with Duff and Slash when they played, Tattoo played before Calder Park.
Yep.
And so I went down to watch him play at the Palace, and we ended up in Topolino's, having a pizza together, and then we finished up in the Linden Tree.
Yeah.
And just drinking. And, I mean, the first time I saw them on Countdown, I was scared.
Oh, yeah. That was scary. Yeah.
But I remember putting my hand out to meet Pete Wells, and he seemed to have a wheelbarrow on the end of his arm.
Yeah.
My hand just disappeared in his hand. Yeah. And I was just like, he was just, because he had the big hair then and stuff. So going out on the piss with him was fantastic. And then the sun was coming up and we're still drinking away there. And then he goes, fuck, what time is it? He goes, I've got to be at Calder Park at 9 o'clock. I go, shit, you better get going. So that was the end of our drink. But he said that was the hardest gig he'd ever done in his whole life, because it was like 42 degrees.
Yeah.
And Rose Tattoo, I think, opened Skid Row, Skid Row and Gunners. And he said he was that hungover, he didn't even stay for the gig, because he didn't go to sleep, and 40 degrees, and I don't know how many stubbies he'd put down. He was a big lad.
He was a big fella. It was at a benefit just before he passed, and Lucy was playing. But Angry, I think I played guitar with Angry that night, and backstage Angry sat me down and went, oh, Tim, you can't let the cunt get you down. You've got to get the band back together. I said, oh, sorry, Angry, but the band's never broken up. And he went, oh, shit. I'm going to be over here.
Yeah. Is there a secret to keep the band together for that long?
I can only speak from my perspective that you just got to realise your place where you fit best in that group. With you and I, it's really easy because musically I just write the bones of the song, and Andy and Russ and Davey are far better musicians, and that's great. I'm glad to be there. And socially, I can talk a good game and be good for about 15 minutes, and then I just have to be by myself, so I disappear. So socially, I know where I fit. I'm good in small doses. I just sort of know my place, and I think we really like each other. But having time off from each other's been important. The only time, there's been a couple of flare-ups in the past couple of years, but it was sort of late 90s, and I was having a lot of smoke blown up my ass about songwriting. And so we'd be recording in Los Angeles, and I'd be taken out for dinner and go to clubs and get the blow, and Russ and Andy would not be there, and I'd look around and wonder, and I thought it was that they didn't want to be around me, but it was really that I was being selective treatment. Separated. So we didn't hang out a lot then. We'd get back to Sydney, where we were living at the time, and we wouldn't hang out. And then years later, when all the number of wheels fell off and I was not doing well, and the band had gone down a lot of pegs, and as it should have been, and then we just started hanging out together. Meet you at the pub. Great. And they're really good fun socially.
Mm.
Dave and I live in each other's pockets. Andy's incredible on the juice. Loves it, but he's selective about it. He won't go every night. He'll one out of every three or four, and I want to be around when he's a bit loose. And Russ is Russ. He's probably been exactly the same since he was an 18-year-old. He's just smarter.
Mm.
And when Russ joined, when Mark left the band, or I asked him to leave, and Russ was my hero, and I had to completely change the way I play because he's a completely different drummer to Mark. And I reckon that's a better way than telling a drummer, or anyone actually, can you play this way?
Yeah.
To play counterintuitively or instinctively. I think that's the secret also, is to allow yourself to play differently and bend a little bit, acquiesce even socially. Because it tends to be, you know, 3 a.m. is when bands break up, or actually 6 a.m. You have a fight at 3 a.m. Everyone goes, punches a wall somewhere at a 6 a.m. Fuck this, I'm catching a train to Stuttgart and I'll catch the next flight home. And some people just aren't wired that way, where they can't back down and they need to get that point across, you know. Mm. And when we were touring with, or we just did a couple of shows with Brian Jonestown, and you can pick it up pretty quick that Anton is just that of that character where it's his outfit, and you just go, well, that's fine, but you're going to have a lot of fallout because it's better just trying to be a good part of the group, I think.
It's a group. That's the key word, group. It's a group. It's a group that make it. It's great to have you at the farm.
It's good to see
Bloody
you,
mate. Unreal. And I think we'll have to catch up more often. One, come over here, park the car.
Yep.
We'll put the car keys on the hook.
Dig them in the dirt.
Yeah, and then we'll have a...
have a session.
We'll have a quiet session because I've got the tub of lies down there. I've got the old spa.
The tub of lies,
I call it. But when my parents moved out of here, I had no furniture. I just slept in that big house there just with a mattress on the floor. I had a record player and a mattress.
Yeah.
So come back from tour and I'll go, I've got some money. I'll go buy furniture. I'll come back with a spa. And I basically lived in this spa for the next 4 years. It was great. I'd eat in it.
Did you come out looking like a ball sack?
Basically, yeah. It explains how I look now, actually. I've probably aged something. I might have, actually, there was that much tequila floating around in there. It probably preserved me.
Yes.
But we have to get on the turbs.
It seemed that at a particular point that you actually stopped aging. Yeah. Maybe around 30 or 40, I'm not sure. But then you don't look any different than you did to me.
Yeah, well.
When you hit 40, maybe.
So, yeah, probably. The hair fell out. Apart from that, I haven't grown mentally since I was 14, I think, which I'm pretty happy about, actually. It's all to the attitude, isn't it, mate?
Silly little things.
Silly little things.
That's the way we're going to get through the next tour and then the next one and the next one.
Silly, silly little things. All right, mate. See you soon.
Great to see you, Roscoe.
Bye. Well, there you have it. Just a couple of mates chatting about silly little things. Thanks to Tim for coming out and paying me a visit. Can't wait to get you in the tub of lies, mate. Tim is playing a venue near you sometime soon, so you should check out his Instagram, which is Tim Rogers Official, something or other. Look, he'll post about what he's up to or something like that. I don't know how any of that works. How You Going is produced by Sam Loy, with Matt Weston as the executive producer. It's proudly supported by Heaps Normal and Bodriggy Brewing, the best brewskis going around. Look, I hope you stick around and be with me on the next episode where I'll be catching up with one of my oldest friends in the rock world, Danita Sparks from L7. Here's a sneaky look.
Maybe your demise can be falling out of a coconut tree like Keith Richards, which almost happened. He fell out of a coconut tree. Do you know
that's
that?
Right. Yeah, that's right. I remember that. It nearly killed him.
Nearly killed him. People were laughing at him about that, and I thought, man, dream on, fuckers, because that's a pretty good way to go.
And remember, the Cosmic Psychos are touring in November as we try to flog our new album, I Really Like Beer. Check out thecosmicpsychos.com.au for all the drip tray details. All right, I've got to get out of here. I'll see you soon.
How you going, yeah?
Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.